You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. Whether we like it or not, big tech companies are changing the way the world works. The size and scale of companies like Google and Facebook give them power that has traditionally been reserved for governments. To help us understand this shift in power, we are speaking today with Ambassador Kasper Klunge. Is that right?
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. The world's first tech ambassador and Denmark's liaison to the Silicon Valley. He was able to be the first person to explain to former Secretary of State John Kerry what blockchain and Bitcoin were. That's an interesting tidbit I didn't know about my old boss. Welcome to the program. Welcome to World Class.
Thanks very much, Mike.
So this is fascinating that you have the job you do, that you have the mission you do. Tell us, what is tech diplomacy? What are the goals and what are you seeking to achieve with tech diplomacy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm speaking to a fellow ambassador, of course. So you know the old ways of diplomacy.
That's right.
And to some extent, I would argue that we're actually bringing diplomacy back to its roots. So you mentioned before that we now have an embassy basically to technology and digitalization, not only, by the way, focusing on Silicon Valley, but also focusing on global affairs, or have a global mandate, in fact, a global team.
But so that's interesting. Let's just pause on for a moment. So you're based here, but you have people that report to you in other parts of the world? Is that how that works?
That's exactly how it is. It's almost sort of a virtual embassy. So the main part of my team is here in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley. Part of it is in Copenhagen in Europe, and part of it is in Beijing in China. And in fact, we're opening up a presence also in Nairobi in Kenya in not too distant future. So it's really also about refocusing what diplomacy is, what a diplomatic representation is, and how you work with global topics that has massive transformational potential in it. So it's a different approach. But what I would just say, I mean, speaking to a fellow ambassador, what we do on a daily basis is in fact very close to what I did in my previous job. I was ambassador to Indonesia before coming here. It's about, you know, basically defending our national interests, trying to seek to influence the area we work with. In our case, it's the big technology companies,
right?
Google, Facebook, Tencent, Alibaba. But the way we work and the way my team is organized is not far away from how diplomatic embassies are traditionally.
We'll explain that a little bit for our listeners, because I don't think most of them have any idea what ambassadors do generally. So what's a typical week like as a tech ambassador?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is I never had that question when I was ambassador in Indonesia when I was heading the European Union down in Kosovo. Nobody ever asked me that question. Nobody said, why do we need an ambassador to Indonesia or country X?
That's funny.
And I get that, if not on a daily basis, then at least on a weekly basis. So what does a tech ambassador do? Well, first of all, it's about establishing networks with the epicenters of transformation. And in the old days, it was very much conflict-driven. You had you sent emissaries to areas where countries were in conflict with each other. What we are arguing and what the Danish government is arguing is that today, the major areas of transformation, the epicenters of tectonic shifts on a global scale, is in fact technology and digitalization.
Right.
So what we do is we work with, you know, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Microsofts, the Alibabas, the Tencents of this world, and we bring to the headquarters questions or issues on behalf of Danish authorities. So what does that mean in practice? It means that on one day, I might be going to Facebook to talk about Cambridge Analytica and the data breaches that faced, you know, in our case, 42,000 Danes. What are they
42,
doing about
000?
42? I know the numbers coming out of Denmark are not impressive when you're sitting in the US, but
no,
for
but
Denmark,
these
it's
are
a
your
relatively
citizens,
high number.
Yes, you're representing them, right?
That's right. So we might bring those topics to the headquarters. Another day, it might be to talk about, how do we avoid digital taxation becoming an existential issue for, you know, the Scandinavian welfare system or the European Union, because these digital companies on average pays half as much in taxes as traditional companies. So it's a very wide range of topics. But it's also an offer, and I think that's important for me to say, you know, the value proposition we bring to the headquarters is also to say, well, you might not be big fans of the European Union's general data protection regulation. Let's have a talk about that. How can we get that right so that we don't stifle innovation, that we don't, you know, put obstacles in the way of commercial activities. We're not out to get Silicon Valley. We're out to work closer together with Silicon Valley in a partnership. But it takes two to tango, and perhaps we need some of the C-suite people to realize that a little bit more in the future than we've seen in the past.
So far. Well, tell our listeners, you just mentioned what sounds like one of the central issues, right? GDPR. Explain a little bit what that is. I don't think most Americans or our listeners would understand the issues at play there, other than everybody here in the Valley says it's horrible and awful.
That's right. That's right. And I would have been a wealthy man if I had gotten a dime every time somebody complained about the European Union and GDPR in the past 14 months. It's basically a new piece of legislation that was introduced in May that makes it crystal clear that personal data is indeed personal data, that you need consent to use that personal data, whether you are a commercial company or whether you are government like the one I represent.
Sounds like a good idea to me. So why is it so controversial?
Because it puts obstacles in the way of using data for commercial activities. It's much more difficult whether you run ads or whether you want to use sort of for analytical work. Today, you need the full consent of you and me if you're working out of Europe. And that there's a question mark around that. I think where there is valid to the questions is, of course, is this going to make it more difficult for us to build the machine learning equipment or the artificial intelligence of tomorrow because of the obstacles of getting access to data? I think that's the valid point.
Right.
But I think, Mike, there is momentum behind what Europe did. You know, California is basically introducing something which is GDPR.
So the law, explain to our listeners, the law passed, right, here in California?
Oh, yeah, no, it's up and running. And you know, I returned from India a few weeks ago. India is now talking about introducing something similar.
Uh-huh.
So things are happening on personal data protection. And of course, you worked for the White House for many years. And, you know, the previous chief of staff had this quote that I enjoy a lot, never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think that's
Rahm Emanuel, right? That's what he said.
That's what he said. And that's exactly what we've seen also with, you know, Cambridge Analytica, some of the scandals. People don't question as much now as they did 14 months ago why we need to stipulate once and for all that personal data is personal data.
Right. That makes sense to me. Tell us a couple of the other, like the agenda items, right? Like when I was ambassador in Russia, I could have named for you, you know, what were my top three or four main agenda items when I dealt with the Russian government. It was Syria, Edward Snowden when he showed up when I was ambassador, you know, arms control issues, and issues about democracy and human rights. We had our kind of top four or five sets of talking points that every time I was in with some government official, we would touch on those. What you mentioned GDPR, that's probably at the top, right? Or close. What's two, three, and four in terms of issues you're trying to discuss with the companies here?
Well, I would mention one topic that, you know, I'd love to have your views on as well, which is for cybersecurity and the cyber attacks that we're seeing globally and the role of Russia and non-state actors coming out of Russia as well. So that's a topic that we focus a lot on, also because we've had our sort of 9/11 moment in Denmark last year with the NotPetya attack that hit one of our largest companies in a very hard way. One issue.
Tell a little bit more about that. That was a huge, important issue that I don't think lots of Americans have heard about.
Well, at the end of June 2017, the NotPetya attack originated out of Ukraine, and it, you know, extremely quickly spread basically as a global virus. And one of our largest corporations, Maersk Line, a shipping company, was very hard hit by it. And, you know, I was actually sitting in Jakarta as our bilateral ambassador at that stage, and I saw literally with my own eyes the impact, the damage that virus did.
That virus had.
They had no idea what was inside the containers. We needed special permissions for them to unload onto the docks. So it was
a
very dramatic.
And they didn't because they lost the data that we're supposed to tell
basically
you?
Basically took out the IT infrastructure of the company in a very, very dramatic and very fast way. So that was sort of our awakening call, if you like. And we've set in motion, like many other European countries or a country around the world, a process to define how do we become better at protecting ourselves, our critical infrastructure, et cetera. But I think, I mean, perhaps getting a question back to you, Mike.
It's interesting the way you phrase it. I don't think we've had our 9/11 moment in the cyber world. And I'm surprised by that. You know, I would have thought that 2016 was that moment. In fact, I was one of the advocates for recommending that the U.S. Congress establish a commission, a bilateral, bipartisan, maybe nonpartisan commission, not unlike what we did after 9/11, to study what happened systematically and then to write a report about what to do in the future. I mean, that's what we did after September 11th. And people forget, you know, one, not everybody was enthusiastic about doing that. And two, you know, when you do something like that, you review mistakes that were made by the government. And I think there are two reasons why it didn't happen. One obvious, one maybe not so obvious. Though the obvious reason is that our president, President Trump, has just time and again refused to acknowledge that we had this attack. I think he's got a reason to do that. He's worried about the legitimacy of his presidential election. I think there was a different course of action that he could have taken, which was just to say, hey, this, I didn't do this, and to let the investigation move forward. But he chose a different path. He chose a path of denial. And remember, I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty certain that he must have been briefed on it even while he was a candidate, because, you know, the candidates are briefed by our intelligence community in real time. And to this day, he just calls it a hoax and, you know, much ado about nothing. Even the much smaller thing that Mr. Mueller, my former colleague, by the way, in the government, he ran the FBI when I was there, has been investigating. So that's by way of explanation, not excuse. I think it is a big mistake. I think we did miss a big opportunity, in part because we have not taken steps to make our society more secure, let alone just our electoral infrastructure. And two, you know, Mr. Mueller's investigation focuses mostly on criminal activity. But what we're talking about, just as you were talking about with your case, it's about national security. It's not just about Absolutely. Criminality. And so I think that was a big missed opportunity for America.
And I think, I don't know whether you would agree on this, Mike, but I think that's exactly the difference between cyber wars and more traditional conventional wars, that the distinction between what is criminality and what is sort of military actions becomes very blurred. And, you know, whether you sit in Europe or whether you sit in the US, I think the activities of Russia is, of course, on top of the agenda. And my foreign minister last week said that not all cyber attacks or misinformation campaigns are coming out of Russia,
right,
but they are certainly in a league on their own in this area. You're an expert on Russian affairs. You spent 2 years there as the ambassador. What's the motive behind Russia acting in what looks like a very destructive manner on cyber attacks?
Well, I'm not sure I know, generally speaking. Countries that I know the best, my own and Ukraine, I think there are two different dimensions. One, in 2016, Putin had a preference for Trump and for very rational reasons, by the way. President Trump, then candidate Trump, said a lot of things that were in the interest of Russia as the way that Putin defines them. Notice I didn't say Russia's national interest, because those are defined by different leaders and different people, but the way he defined them. You know, he talked about lifting sanctions, looking into recognizing Crimea, said many critical things about NATO, and said nothing about democracy and human rights, whereas his opponent, my former boss, Secretary Clinton, said the exact opposite on all those. So clearly Putin had a preference in that game, and he said it very bluntly in the Helsinki summit he had with Trump. He said, Я хотел, чтобы он выиграл. You know, I wanted him to win. And in very, you don't need a PhD in Russian studies to figure that out. He made it pretty clear. And so the interventions that they did, both in stealing data and publishing it, their social media, and I want to get back to that because I think that is a huge issue with the companies here. And then the meetings that he had with various Trump officials, the count is now up to 14. So a large number of people. That was all designed to help Trump win. I do, however, think there is another agenda, which is just to exacerbate tensions in our society and to undermine the legitimacy of democracy more generally. You know, I've gotten to know Putin over the years. Wouldn't say we're Facebook friends, but although you never know, you know, who's trolling me on Facebook every night. But maybe it's Putin disguised as Natasha or Olga. But in all seriousness, he's got a very cynical view of democracy. He actually doesn't think our system is any different than his. He thinks the state kind of controls everything. And he wants to downplay and degrade the attractiveness of liberal democratic institutions more generally. That serves his personal interests. So I think that's the second dimension of his attacks. But that's probably universal, right? That's probably what he's doing in Europe as well.
Well, that's how it looks, at least when you're sitting in Europe. And again, I think what is sometimes difficult fully to understand is whether this is a purely destructive effort. What are the long-term goals of achieving that? You know the numbers better than I do. But if you look at the size of the Russian economy, it's not too far away from the Nordic countries collectively. So it's actually relatively small.
Kind of amazing, huh?
Kind of amazing, especially when you look at sort of how the superpower aspect is being portrayed also internationally. But I think just going back to the mandate and what we're looking at on our side is very much also about sort of the geopolitics of technology. How is technology going to have an impact on the balance of power? I think the shift from the West towards the East that we talk a lot about in international relations aspects is actually going to be technology is going to be a catalyst for actually making that move or that transition even stronger over the next couple of years.
Right.
And I think there's a fundamental aspect in what we are trying to do, and that is to look at whether technology is going to be a means of liberation and freedom, or whether technology is going to be a useful tool for control, societal control, also on a global scale. So if you ask me, Mike, you know, what are the main battlefronts looking into the next decade? I think that's basically it. You know, what role will technology play, and can we get the companies to play ball and help defend some of the key values that most of us would like to adhere to?
Right. Well, I couldn't agree with you more on that. In fact, one of the programs we had at FSI here several years ago was called Liberation Technology. It was run by my colleague Larry Diamond, and now it has a different name precisely because of what you just described. Let me build on that. A question I wanted to ask you, in your sense of, because you know the company is probably better than anybody by now, one of the tricky spaces in that is about freedom of speech issues versus the use of these platforms for foreign intervention, right? And the Russians are one actor, but they're not the only. I'm just curious, because you know our country fairly well by now, give us a sense to our listeners about how Europe approaches that set of issues versus the way you think we're doing it here in the United States.
I'm actually not sure there's that big a difference in the approach. I think when you live and work inside sort of a liberal democracy, it is a very, very fine line, a very fine trade-off between freedom of speech, which is a fundamental right, a human right, and we're sitting basically on the day of the Human Rights Declaration.
That's right. Thanks for reminding us.
So that's and you know, my government and Denmark, that's something we would always adhere to. On the other hand, what we're seeing is, of course, attempts to undermine our democracy, our election processes. We'll have elections in Denmark within the next couple of months.
Oh,
and of course, we have serious concerns on the ability of foreign actors, be it state actors or non-state actors, to seek to influence the direction of these elections. And how we get that right is a very, very difficult conversation, whether you're government or whether you represent the civil society. Part of the response, in our view, is to make sure that we work much closer together with the industry. And if you want me to sort of say, give you a couple of takeaways after 14 months in this job.
Yeah.
I think it is important that we see the industry taking a societal responsibility at a level we haven't seen before. You know, there are choices to be made. You know, not everything is as good as the other decision.
Right.
And I think that's not only true on a societal scale, but eventually, and that's at least my own view, that will also be true from a commercial point of view, because I think you will see consumers and Western democracies aligning or perhaps getting closer together in the understanding that it's a shared responsibility. It takes two to tango.
And if they don't do that, that actually could hurt their market share? Is that what you think?
I think what we're trying to do is to some extent also raise the risks of not playing ball.
Right.
And I don't want to say that an embassy is a watchdog, but of course it goes without saying that we have now access and we report back to our decision makers. We disseminate information, be it on, you know, more civil things like autonomous vehicles. How is that technology going to transform our societies?
Right.
Healthcare is another good example. But of course, also, are these platforms being misused for spreading extremist views or helping to undermine election processes? Those are not small issues. These are very big issues. It's foreign policy issues at its core. And I think we might come back to talk about the transatlantic dimension of this, which is dear to my heart, and where I really see the necessity of us working much closer together.
Well, I agree with you on that. Not everybody in our government does, unfortunately. But one, just a couple of questions on the mechanics of your diplomacy. So one thing that's different, of course, is that these companies don't have ambassadors yet around the world, or do they? Or is that their public policy shops? Or is that who are the people doing your work in countries that they're involved in?
I think the jury's still out on that question, whether that is the case. I think, you know, you cannot find any of the big companies where they don't have, you know, an army of lawyers or lobbyists working out of D.C. or in Brussels, our case, or even in Copenhagen. You have sales offices that represent the interest of the companies vis-a-vis authorities, etc. Okay. But I think what we're seeing is also, you know, you have sort of the Brad Smiths of this world. You know, I would almost argue that those are representatives on global issues.
Explain to our listeners who Brad is.
He's the president and chief legal officer of Microsoft.
Right.
Really good a colleague and somebody we work very closely together with. Uh-huh. But I think what you're seeing Microsoft and Brad Smith doing is, of course, to also move around, travel around, promoting a digital Geneva Convention or a tech accord, getting the industry to sign up to some fundamental principles on cyber attacks.
Right.
Reasoning.
We're doing it without the government involved, but self-regulation is that.
And I think that's the interesting thing for politicos like us who are interested in global affairs, that we are seeing something which is going to challenge the traditional roles of governments or states, where the private sector is assuming a responsibility or role,
right,
which is perhaps not the same but similar to what governments or states would have done in the past,
right.
And our response to that is to create an embassy to the industry, not because we want to put companies before countries, that's very important for me to say,
right,
but because we think it is necessary for us to defend core values, core interests vis-a-vis the companies. Whether we're doing it the right way, I don't know, but it's certainly an attempt to try and defend the role of governments and states in the next decade.
Well, pretty exciting that you're the first. Why doesn't the EU have an ambassador here?
But it might also come further down
the road.
Or
are you that de facto?
No. Okay. But what has been interesting is we are working very closely together with other European countries because we are the only ones so far.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's crystal clear that I represent the Kingdom of Denmark, but we've been working very closely together with other European countries at the same time. I think you asked before, what are sort of the main trajectories of what we're doing.
Yeah, I got us off track for a minute. Yeah,
no,
tell us
no,
more,
it's super
yeah.
interesting. No, what I just wanted to point out is actually one of our KPIs is also to put technology more firmly on the international agenda. So I work a lot with the industry, but my team also works a lot with the United Nations. You know, we work with the European Union. Just Thursday, Friday, here in Silicon Valley, we hosted the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on digital cooperation.
Oh, you did? I read about that, yeah.
And we gave some input, and we had sort of collected a group of interesting people around the table to input into the work of this high-level panel why technology or digitalization is going to be a very positive transformer, but also something where we have to be very careful that we don't see a digital divide,
right?
Because that will be the root causes of migration flows or even extremism as we go along. Similarly, you've seen other countries appoint, have not tech ambassadors, but special envoys on technology or cyber ambassadors, etc. So, you know, I don't feel completely alone out here. We are seeing other countries doing something along the same lines, and we encourage that and we welcome that because, you know, I represent an extremely small country at the northern end of Europe, and we need to bandwagon with other countries to have an impact on the industry, but also on global affairs.
I noticed you used the phrase KPI. In government, when I was ambassador, we used the phrase deliverables. Tell our listeners what a KPI is.
Well, a key performance indicator.
Right.
So it's basically, I guess, goals and targets from, and I guess we adopted that from the private sector.
Yep.
And
so you're already taking on the language of
I've gone native, my
friend. Locals. That's right. Well, we need to end here, but what happens next? Do you cycle back into a regular ambassadorial slot, or are you now in this different world that you might be on a different trajectory for the rest of your career.
No, I'm a pretty standard career diplomat.
Right.
So eventually I'll go back to doing another job inside the foreign ministry. But I, you know, I'll share this small secret with you, Mike, that I think I'm privileged to have one of the most interesting jobs in international diplomacy right now. And I'm not saying this because I come from Denmark, but I actually think that the idea, and it was not my idea to come up with a tech ambassador and the arguments behind it, is extremely valuable. And
yes.
Again, these are big topics, it's big issues. And I think, you know, we have relationships with many countries around the world. But if I had to point to one area that I think is going to be dramatically impacting both how Denmark as a country is run, but also how we can be a responsible player internationally, technology is going to be a key parameter.
You know, I couldn't agree more. I wish I had your job. It sounds fantastic. And at this moment in time in history, especially, I can't imagine more important work. So congratulations on the job you have. Good luck. And we'll have you back on World Class.
Would be my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like the episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners to find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.